Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on the Akanka Sutta, the Sutta on Wishes Granted. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches that if one wishes to be truly helpful and compassionate, and to be recognized for being helpful and compassionate, then one should develop the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. This talk is recorded at our Saturday morning Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 10th, 2016. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you.
This morning's talk is on the Akanka Sutta, which is sometimes characterized as the Wishes Granted Sutta, but it very specific wishes. It came about because the Buddha, a lot of the Buddha's teachings came about just this way. He noticed some of the applications of his Dhamma were getting a little bit misunderstood or misapplied, and it really is remarkable how many sutras are just that way, just simple, direct, practically applied. And so this sutta is about the wish to be doing good in the world, but also to be recognized for doing good and the proper way to go about that. And there's a modern correlation. Much of modern Buddhism, and again, I'm not putting it down, but much of modern Buddhism is based on the premise of engaged Buddhism, meaning that your practice is to be engaged in social remedies, more so than developing the Dhamma first. And so this was common even 2,600 years ago. And the Buddha's teaching, and this isn't just this one sutta, there's a lot of suttas address this in different ways, and I talk about it a lot. The Buddha's teaching that if we really are concerned about humanity and our relation to other people and the planet, the world we live in, the most important thing is to awaken, because then we can truly be of service. It's through understanding our own confused and deluded thinking and resulting disappointing behavior and experiences. By understanding that, then we can truly understand the cause of the world's problems. And so it's not just being against something. It's really being for awakening and understanding the truth of reality. And if you think about that, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? How can I help you if I don't know what's wrong with me? How can I help the world until I understand my own contributions to the world's troubles? And if I really want to be a responsible person, my first responsibility is to stop contributing to the world's ills. And so the Buddha speaks to that here. In the Akanka Sutta, the Buddha addresses the assembled Sangha on the wish to be helpful to others. He teaches that having a mind inclined to compassion and wisdom is noble. The Buddha also teaches that developing awakening within the Eightfold Path carries responsibilities of behavior and Dhamma practice. There's a right way to act, there's a right way to develop the Dhamma, especially if we're looking about to be truly helpful. If your wish is to be held dear by your Sangha, to be respected and inspiring to them, listen closely to my words. If your wish is that the gifts you receive be of benefit to all, listen closely to my words. If your wish is that thoughts of you bring benefit to all, listen closely to my words. If your wish is to be free of ever-changing conditions of emotional and physical upset, listen closely to my words. If your wish is to overcome disappointment, worry, and fear, listen closely to my words. If your wish is to attain unwavering mindfulness and pleasant abiding moment by moment, listen closely to my words. If your wish is to attain the end of delusion and distraction, listen closely to my words. Friends, remain free of taking life. Remain free of taking what is not offered. Remain free of sexual misconduct. Remain free of hurtful speech. Remain free of intoxicating substances. And bring, so the Buddha is talking about the five precepts. Bring these precepts to perfection. Friends, commit to develop tranquility. Now he's talking directly about meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Friends, commit to develop tranquility. Be mindful of meditative absorption. Now he's talking about the jhanas. Be a meditative absorption and useful insight. Useful insight means insight into the three marks of existence. So again, Even back then, the Buddha realized that people became enamored with the idea of just gaining insight into anything, insight to a turtle walking across the street, and overemphasizing and actually creating clinging to mundane exercises. There was a book that came out quite a few years ago when I was dabbling in Zen. I can't think of it. The whole book was based on the premise of being mindful. When you're washing the dishes, I think it was, I can't think of the title. But when you're washing the dishes, to be mindful of the dishes. And that's good. We should be mindful of what we're doing. When we're washing the dishes, we should be there washing the dishes. But not to overemphasize it simply because I'm focused on being mindful of scrubbing a dish, that I'm on the path to awakening. There's a lot more to it than that. And that idea of being mindful of washing the dishes or watching the turtle or watching the sunset, that true mindfulness is developed through the Eightfold Path. It's not developed by simply doing it, because we have conditioned mind, we have conditioned thinking. And so even that wish to be helpful to others, if it's rooted in ignorance, remember dependent origination, it often can result in creating more harm to other people rather than actually being a benefit. And some of the most obvious examples would be the Crusades or other religious types of Crusades. These people, you know, I always use Hitler because it's such an obvious point. In his mind and in the minds of the Crusaders, they were absolutely right in what they were doing. They believed that they were doing something good for humanity, or at least their little slice of humanity. Incredibly deluded because they hadn't developed an understanding of what was really occurring. And we can do that in individual ways, and we do it in individual ways, and we also do it in groups, and I don't want to get into a big political talk, but because we're defending something, we might be defending animal rights, but we don't mind killing people over defending animal rights. A little bit crazy, isn't it? You know, you should be concerned about everything. The Buddha concludes, train yourself in this manner, and be mindful of even the slightest deviation. So how do we do that? We develop the Eightfold Path, and specifically right speech, action, and livelihood addresses all of our thoughts, words, and deeds. So this is another brief sutta from the Pali Canon that, if understood and developed, will bring lasting peace and happiness. As is typical of the Buddha's teaching, he does not teach the manipulation of personal or societal conditions, as these conditions are all rooted in impermanence. He teaches to immediately abandon any behavior that would contribute to other suffering. He does not teach to embrace suffering or to observe suffering. That's another common application of Buddhism, that if the first noble truth is suffering, all we really need to do is to be mindful of it and observe it arising in our life. That's really not, the Buddha never taught that. He never taught to just be mindful of suffering. That's kind of the same to me as being mindful of washing the dishes. I never found that terribly pleasant either, but I've let that go. Be mindful of the path leading to the cessation of our own origination and continuation of suffering. That's the point, not just observing it. So we can observe the suffering in our lives all we want, but unless we have that strong intention, second factor of the Eightfold Path, to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, all we're doing is focusing on suffering. And the human mind is such that what we focus on, what we hold in mind, is what we're going to experience. And if we're focused on simply observing suffering, we're going to experience suffering. In fact, we're going to probably experience it in very acute ways. Another way of explaining that, this is back probably about maybe a year and a half ago. I got a call, and I've talked about this a few times here. I got a call from someone who just hadn't heard of me. In fact, I've yet to meet him. I thought we were. He called me up, and I could tell immediately there was some panic in his voice. And I said, just tell me what's the problem. Maybe I can help you. And he says, well, I've been a Buddhist practitioner for, I'm going to remember the date, for 20 years. I'm 38 years old. I have a beautiful wife. I have 3 kids. I have a great house in Newtown, Pennsylvania. He says, I'm living the American dream. And he says, and I feel like I got nothing in my life. And immediately I'm getting an inclination. I think I know where he's going. I said, well, tell me a little bit about your practice. He says, well, I've been a Zen practitioner for 20 years. And I says, well, what's your meditation like? He says, for 20 years I've been sitting shikantaza. Shikantaza means just sitting. It's a Japanese term for just sitting. And I've been focusing on nothingness. And I said, tell me again what you just said. He says, I've been sitting shikantaza, focusing on nothingness. And over the phone, I could hear the light bulb going off in his eyes. He said, holy S. And he got it just by that. I've been focusing on nothingness. And what does he have in his life? Nothing. What we focus on is what we're going to get. In Dhamma practice, if we focus on the Dhamma practice itself, what we will get is release from clinging. If we're focused on creating more clinging, even clinging to the idea of I'm going to notice suffering, or clinging to the idea that I'm going to save the rainforest. It's a good idea to save the rainforest, but if we do that before we awaken, we can often create an identity over I'm a crusader, and then that becomes our practice. And the most important thing in our practice is not awakening, it's saving the rainforest or any other social cause. And that's the problem. This overemphasis on one aspect of the three marks of existence is a misapplication of mindfulness and does not develop understanding of the underlying confusing and unsatisfactory nature of life. The Buddha teaches to penetrate to the cause of suffering, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths resulting in craving and clinging in an impermanent environment. Remember, ignorance, a very specific ignorance, leads to all this. It's ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha consistently taught the Dhamma always in the context of the Four Noble Truths. In this short sutta, the Buddha teaches the importance of developing moral and ethical behavior through the Eightfold Path. Right view inclines the mind away from ego-driven pursuits and towards the Dhamma. Right intention is strengthened through mindfulness of the skillful desire to be truly helpful and to recognize what is unskillful. To be of benefit to all, we must start with our own behavior and be mindful of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. This brings mindfulness of craving and clinging, including and most importantly, clinging to views that further the establishment of a self prone to confusion and further suffering. Right effort develops a refined mindfulness to recognize and abandon what would otherwise lead to further confusion and suffering. Right mindfulness is to be mindful of the Eightfold Path and avoids becoming distracted by conceptual applications of the Dhamma. And finally, Shamatha Vipassana meditation develops the profound concentration necessary to develop useful insight into impermanence, not self, and the unsatisfactoriness of dukkha. There's a little bit more to the article, but I'm going to stop there. And so, in the article and in the Buddha's teaching, he's describing, again, putting an emphasis on developing the entire path, the complete path to awakening, rather than just focusing on being a certain way. And many, many times, it's kind of convenient to think that at the end of the Dhamma path, an awakened human being is naturally compassionate and honest and loving and present, so that all I have to do is act that way. I can act like I'm an awakened human being, and in that acting, I'll become an awakened human being. But it doesn't work. Why is that? Because we're still, as compassionate as I might be, without the Eightfold Path, I still have that conditioned thinking. And I'm still creating an identity of being the world's most compassionate human being. And that's prone to suffering, because at some point I'm going to fail, aren't I? I'm either going to fail myself or some social function that I'm hoping to change is not going to work. And that'll bring disappointment. But if I engage in social renewal from an awakened standpoint, for one thing, my decisions and my actions will be well focused, and I'll understand what I can do and what I can't do. The Buddha was the first awakened one, and he did not set out to save the world, even though he had this incredible compassion. It's what drove him to teach. But what he taught was not how to act in a compassionate way. He taught us how to be most compassionate to ourselves first and develop the Dhamma and develop awakening, because he knew that's the path to lasting peace for everyone, beginning with ourselves. So I think we all have that wish inside of us. We want to be good people. We want to be loving and compassionate. I know even when I was a kid, I can remember that the way I was interacting in the world didn't fit, but I was also pretty angry and confused, so sometimes I would be very aggressive, and it hurt me deeply, but I really didn't have a point of view or a perspective that I could change it at that point. I still continue to act in ways that brought pain to myself and to others. But I couldn't do anything about it, even though I wanted to. And I think we all do. We all want to be compassionate and loving all the time. But sometimes we fall short because of our conditioned thinking, because of the need to protect a point of view or an ego personality. And the Buddha taught a way, the Eightfold Path is a way of letting all that go and simply being present with what's occurring. That's the second time I'll say that's the end of this talk. Any questions about the Akanka Sutta or this talk?
Not a question, but just a comment. That it's a very simple sutta, but you absolutely make it glow. I mean, just your explanation of what the Buddha is trying to say, what the Buddha is saying, it really, you really do bring it to life. And this morning is a beautiful example of your skills.
Thank you. Thank you. It's important for me to hear that, because if I'm going to teach something, I hope I can teach it in a way that's useful. So thank you for saying that.
Anthony, I have a question.
Yes.
What does the Buddha mean by meditative absorption, and does he view that as a positive or a negative?
I don't know if I would answer it as a positive or negative. It's certainly, the Buddha taught the jhanas four levels. Jhana means meditative absorption. And there's four levels of that, beginning with the immediate level of simply quieting our minds and achieving a level of understanding of simply what's occurring right now and being aware of how, as we quiet our minds through shamatha, vipassana, meditation, we first become aware of how sensory input is affecting the way that we're thinking. And then the fourth level is a mind of deep equanimity. So he's simply, and I should say that the jhanas are something that have been so overemphasized that they're portrayed as something that is for only advanced meditators, and only an awakened person can ever achieve that fourth jhana. Almost every one of us in every meditation session, we experience each level of the jhanas. For most of us, especially as beginning meditators, they're very fleeting and we hardly notice it. So the Buddha primarily taught the jhana, so we simply notice that our meditation is working and we're deepening our absorption in meditation. So that's all that the jhanas meant. There's a couple of articles on the website too about that. But it's important for us to recognize that our meditation practice is actually bearing fruit. And that's why he taught it. Just to recognize that we're developing, at least initially, a little measure of calm. Our minds are simply a little bit quieter, a little bit more well concentrated than they were before we started meditating. And then as our practice deepens, we can recognize that we're able to hold that peaceful and calm mind for longer periods of time, until eventually a fully awakened, fully mature human being rests in the fourth jhana, meaning a mind that's calm. When you understand that the Buddha described the quality of mind of an awakened human being, using that term, calm, or at peace, lasting peace, equanimity, and you relate that to the fourth jhana, there's nothing terribly spectacular about achieving that. It's part of the goal. And it's certainly not something for advanced meditators. You know, I don't think there's any such thing as an advanced meditator. There's someone who has developed meditation, but there's no advanced techniques. There's nothing special to do except to develop the path. A great question. Thank you. Any other questions related?
Just that, so to how I can understand this, when you say what you focus on, you become. In other words, you're saying that we should focus on being a compassionate person within the context of the Eightfold Path.
Exactly.
So that you'll understand that it's not so bad when you fall off the path.
Yes, and also...
Or you will get a swelled head when people compliment you.
Yeah. Well, I did. I did. I felt it hitting the ceiling. Yes, and that's such an important point. So the Eightfold Path is characterized as a path of wisdom, virtue, and concentration. The first two factors are the wisdom factors, the middle three are the virtuous factors, and the last three are the concentration factors. As we develop compassion... What the Buddha's found and what I've seen in my life and seen from other people, that compassion without wisdom can often be hurtful. And even if it's not hurtful, usually it's not very effective. It falls on deaf ears. So an aspect of right speech is that what you're saying is actually going to be effective. And if it's not, keep your mouth shut. It's part of right speech. So in other words, I wouldn't be giving this class out on the corner. For one thing, it's a little noisy, but I know that it's falling on deaf ears. I'm wasting my breath and I'm wasting other people's time. Don't do it. When we frame our compassion through right view and right intention, then our resulting actions will be inspired by that wisdom that's developed from right view and right intention. We know that we're good to go. You know, we will remain harmless in what we're doing. We won't do things like cause harm for other people just to protect my view or my cause. What's going on in Burma, there's Buddhist monks in robes actually killing people to protect Buddhism and keep, it's called Rohingya, but it's a form of a Muslim religion, keep them at bay. It's ridiculous. But they, in their view, in their confused view, they feel justified. They're protecting their Buddhism, their brand of Buddhism. They couldn't have developed it very far if they think that's okay to do that. It's ridiculous. But we do that all the time. So to get away from the negative, there's so much freedom. When I first started developing the Eightfold Path, became, like I talk about it, the framework for my life. And as I really grasped what I was doing, a lot of the second guessing in my life, a lot of the uncertainty in my life fell away, because I realized that if I'm acting within the framework of the Eightfold Path and my behavior is framed by right speech, right action, and right livelihood, there's nothing else I can do. And I know that I'll be remaining harmless. It doesn't mean that other people might get upset at what I say or do, but my intention was pure. And so the karmic results were pure too. No, I'm not. I get a lot of people upset just because of the way I present the Buddhist teaching. You know, you should read some of the comments on Tricycle Magazine. But my intention is not to disparage anybody or anything, but simply to be clear about what the Buddha taught. And you know, and that to me, that's an aspect of right speech. Any other questions? Okay, we'll meditate, then we'll go around the room. You're welcome. Wow.
I want to say something else that happened. I think it's interesting because when you're saying that, your talk kind of made me see the difference between being mindful. Like when I think I'm being mindful, focus on what I'm doing. But if it's usually the reason that I think about that is because I'm not liking what I'm doing, and I'm having some kind of uncomfortable feeling about it. So, then I can get into this weird headspace of like, focus on what you're doing because you don't like it, but you're making a judgment about it, and there's this kind of negativity. But then there's other times where I'm kind of like throwing the cold water on my face figuratively and saying, no, wait, what is occurring right now? What is the right view of what's happening? How am I reacting to it? That's okay. There's like the very subtle difference between, and I don't even know how to explain it, but what he's speaking to, like being mindful and having right view. Being mindful of the current moment and having right view.
Yeah, that right view frames the way we see what's occurring.
Yeah, right.
And
so that's helpful because then the next time it happens, I can be like, okay.
So the Buddha taught mindfulness in two specific applications, the four foundations of mindfulness, and then to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path, meaning to hold in mind. And so when we're acting in a way that is not within that framework, to recognize it and come back into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is that simple. So when we can use mindfulness that way, then the resulting moment-by-moment mindfulness takes care of itself. So one of the things we've been talking about for the last 3 or 4 weeks, somewhat intentionally, was when we get caught up in something that is agitating, and that could be an unpleasant experience, or it could be something that is very pleasant, but we recognize that there's a distraction there in our minds. To just say to yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And you immediately separate your ego self from what's occurring. You see it clearly. This is just what's occurring in my life, and I do not have to attach myself to it. I do not have to take it on myself. It's simply, again, it's simply what's occurring. There's nothing personal to it. There should be nothing personal except to a self-referential ego self, which takes everything personal. You know, we talked about, I don't like black cushions. I like purple. Well, why confuse my mind? Why agitate my mind with that? Except my ego self will use something like that to keep me distracted. This is an unpleasant meditation hall because they don't have enough purple cushions. But we do so. I mean, it's a silly example. We do, yeah. Yeah. You know, so.
Irrelevant.
Yep. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am. And then we can become what we really are, which is free of our ego personality. The Buddha talks about that in an interesting way, that anatta and life situations where we're connected to, he calls it confining places. He called his life in his father's kingdom, in the palace, as a confining place.
Hmm.
Imagine that. Yeah, he was at one point one of the wealthiest people on the planet, and if he lived his life that way, he would die that way. And it was a confining place to him. Why? Because he couldn't develop the Dhamma in that setting.
I have edited out our 20-minute meditation.
So I'd like to hear how your practice is going, and if you have any questions or comments, start with Anthony. Good to see you this morning, my friend.
Good to see you. Enjoyed the talk. And, when you last talked about the Buddha growing up in a palace and having all these things, it sort of like made me think, you know, I go through this struggle lately, pursuing his master's degree in mental health, and the shift is sometimes I think, well, I have a level of success and comfort and, you know, security, and I know what I'm doing and I'm good at it, and versus, you know, taking this chance to go into something else, and it's strictly just because I think it might be a way that I can be happier and better suited with my values, but there's a little bit of fear of giving up something that's secure, like the Buddha gave up the castle and just went out and tried to discover itself. So it sort of resonated with me when you said that.
Yeah, and it wasn't an easy decision for him either, but it was so important for him to gain an understanding of who he was in relation to the world, you know, and where all this came from. So, yeah, it's just, and the fear and the unsettled nature simply is part of an association, you know, and we all do that. We all do it.
Well, you did it too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah.
Because you had a successful business.
And yeah, it was, and in some ways there was some meaning in it. I mean, I like the idea of really doing the best that I could do and having trained my guy and all that, the skillful qualities that you can apply there. But in the end, there wasn't a lot of meaning for it. So in my life,
there wasn't a lot of meaning.
You know, really, really was the bottom line. The motivation was to make money, which is, it's okay. But there wasn't a lot of meaning in it. This is a lot more meaning. Not quite as much money, but
yeah, and that, you know, it's not, money isn't everything.
No, it's not. And this was never meant to, you know, it's evolved to be something that is mostly full-time for me now. But it wasn't my intention. You know, my intention was just to raise a couple bucks for a charity 6-7 years ago, whenever it was. And this is just what's developed. But, you know, life takes us in strange ways. I was meditating for many, many years before. I mean, I never once thought about teaching meditation. It was always like a solitary practice. And then things came up. Tamara, who used to own the Frenchtown acupuncture, asked me to start teaching meditation for charity. That's what did it.
Yeah, I think when you just put yourself out there and you do something you truly love and you're passionate about, that somehow things just start to happen.
Yeah.
The universe opens up for you.
Same for you. I 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you never would have thought of getting a mental health degree, would you? Yeah. When our views change, a lot of times our outward experiences do too. What was once not even a thought then becomes a very important part of our lives.
Yeah. So this week I had a lot of, oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
I had a lot of stuff thrown at us, and you know, a lot of like the potpourri of life's problems. And my wife was reading Thich Nhat Hanh book, and she mentioned the second arrow. So we pulled out your talk and we read it.
Yeah.
And so my whole thing this week is not putting that second arrow on myself.
That's such an important sutta. It really describes the problem.
Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad you found some benefit. Jen, how are you this morning? It's good to see
you. What Anthony said. I got back to school this week, so back to teaching, and there's been a lot of change that's happened in education in my school, a lot of newness, a lot of stuff flying at you all the time, a lot of opportunity to show how amazing you are at your job. And how capable you are of doing everything that comes your way. And that was my perspective this week. Initially it was just, I felt completely overwhelmed and very uncomfortable. And kind of a little bit like lost in terms of, you know, is this even a job that I want to be doing anymore? Mm-hmm. But within like a couple days, it everything kind of cleared, because I started to see how, you know, by using the tools, I started to see how there's all of this opportunity for me to do something because of my ego, to do something to demonstrate how awesome I am, mm-hmm. or to prove myself, or to, you know, it was always about impressing others, not about doing a good job in the way that I know is the best way to do a good job.
Yeah.
So, that was interesting, and it kind of, you know, what Anthony was saying sort of resonated, because I realized that, like, a lot of my stress and distress from last year and beginning, like, the first couple days, was just because I had lost my focus of what is important about my job and what I bring to the table that's really good. You know, I'm not an administrator. I can't run around and get all these other things done. I can't try to get recycling bins, and I can't try to, you know, go to every single parent meeting or go to every single extracurricular thing. I can concentrate on planning a good lesson and implement it. And I can be present with my students and understand exactly what their needs are and you know, teach them how to navigate their world and provide boundaries for them and create a positive container. And so it was just really nice at the end of the week to kind of implement that and ignore everything else that was flying at me. And I immediately had a breakthrough, which I identified as karma, where there was one particular thing that I was getting emails about and something that I could have started to try to deal with that didn't really have a lot to do with my teaching. And I just very uncomfortably ignored it. It was very difficult to just kind of not respond to the emails. It was an email that was sent to like 5 or 6 people, so I didn't have to respond to it. It was any of those other people could have responded to it, and I just, it was not comfortable, and I was thinking about it a lot, and I had to keep putting it away, but I just kept ignoring it, and other people picked it up. People who were in much more powerful position to be able to handle it and they took care of it. And I was like, holy cow, look at that thing that I would have taken on. And they would have, then they wouldn't have done anything because they would have been like, oh, she's taking care of it.
Yeah.
But because I just like stopped trying to be impressive, it just really helped me. Just that one little tiny thing. I actually called my mom yesterday because I was so excited about it.
That's huge.
That's so excited that I like just let something go.
And you didn't get entangled in something that you didn't have to get entangled in.
Right.
You know, and it's an ego self that it says, I have to be in that.
Yeah, it was all ego. So much ego. Yeah.
The outward appearance of what you're doing looks the same to everyone else. In fact, the application is the same. But when you're looking at what you're describing is looking at your intention. What's my intention for doing this? And if your intention is pure, in your role, to be the best teacher you can be, but not so everybody notices, because that's who you are.
Right.
It changes the experience for you.
Right.
And it actually does make you a better teacher, of course it does, or whatever else we're doing.
Right.
Again, it's just a very practical application. This is how it works.
Yeah.
You know, it's how it works.
It's so counterintuitive that you can give yourself more time for yourself and be more successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's so true, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people say that. In fact, I think it's even in the book, because I noticed it myself. It just seemed like there was more time in my day when I started to develop concentration within this right framework, simply because I was making better decisions, and I wasn't wasting my energy on getting that email in before anybody else does,
yeah.
So I get noticed.
Yeah.
Free yourself.
Yeah.
That's
well,
what freedom is.
If like if you're spending your day checking emails and text and you're on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
you're activating your fight or flight response constantly, and you're draining your battery.
Yeah.
And if you just give yourself that little time to do it, and then spend quality time on what you need to spend it on, you're more focused.
Yep.
And less drained.
Yeah.
I'm confident of that.
Yeah, you are. Even the Buddha talks about that.
Really?
Just, you'll simply have more energy. I got to remember the sutta. Maybe I'll teach on it. You will, because you're just not wasting.
The Facebook sutta.
Yeah, you're just not wasting your time. But think about it. Even 2,600 years ago, obviously there was nothing. There was no technology. But it was still a problem. People still look for constant distraction. You know, and they do it in all kinds of ways. And we still do it. Thank you. Laura, good to see you. How are you?
Good to see you, John. I'm good.
Good.
I guess I'm good. It's always a funny question. It seems like it changes all the time.
Yeah.
To be here. I missed having 2 weeks of class, and I just feel like the cobwebs are just creeping. And so last week I intended to come, and I got up and then lied back down and fell asleep, and then woke up and didn't have enough time to get here. Just so upset with myself. Yeah, Jen, thank you for sharing. Congratulations. I was driving over here and I was thinking, I wonder what it looks like to be a fully integrated human being. Like, I have such a strong desire and passion to attain that. And not in a frantic way or anything like that. Or
skillful desire.
Just, in a way that really just fills me with a lot of joy, actually. But I was thinking, what does that look like? And I wanted to form some sort of picture of it, but I wonder, does it look
like
different in every person?
Looks like that.
It looks like that. And so I kind of felt like your talk spoke to that a little bit, because I, within those fleeting seconds of that thought that I had, there was all of these conditioned, thoughts about what it would look like, as far as I'm going to be this, this good and this angelic and this, compassionate and blah, 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 all encompassing, can meet everyone in this way. And, I was like, well, you're not that. So,
yeah.
So I don't know. I am. don't know, there's so many layers of, it feels like there's so many layers to what it means to be a human being in the world, and it changes in every moment due to impermanence, and it's just so easy to cling and crave to those, you know, even when you're, even when my intention, I feel like, is really clear, it's just so easy to get caught up and cling to all these little minute things that meet you at all these different layers of wherever you are in your development. So I think not coming to class for 2 weeks, things start to get a little more confusing for me, even when I've been fairly consistent with my meditation. Glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad you're here. Yeah, thank you for saying that. The Sangha is so important, being a part of it. We're really fortunate to have what we have here. It's somewhat unique. Glad you're here. Mary, how are you? It's good to see you this morning.
The practice has been going pretty well. You know, and obviously meditation is not all of it, but I find myself all the time reminding myself not to go there. That wouldn't be right effort, that wouldn't be right view. And it's easier when you do apply right view, right effort to basically anything, because you're not going to do something harmful to yourself or somebody else.
Yeah.
But it can be very difficult when I hear people say inane things. I have to let it go.
Yeah.
And usually if somebody comes up with something regarding, you know, nutrition, whatever, or medication they read online, and I just let it go, because they're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And again, it's just a practical application. And so it's obvious that you're developing the framework for ultimate right view, to see things clearly and respond appropriately. So good for you. Glad you're here this morning. Lorna, good to see you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here. Getting back to your talk today, it said that that director mentioned alcohol, but it sort of covered
intoxication,
substance,
yep,
abuse. And so, I mean, that's not the occasional glass of red wine, is it? Or does that mean you need to be teetotal, or, you know,
it's a difficult question. I've never found a qualification where the Buddha said, you know, you just don't want to get ripped every night, but a couple glasses of wine. So take it on its face. Any intoxicant can lead to mindlessness, and that's the whole point. So, I mean, I would say that if you enjoy a glass of wine with your dinner and it doesn't lead to mindlessness, I don't think there's any harm. I think everybody knows that I'm involved in the alcoholism and addiction field, directly, and also there's a workshop here this afternoon. That's obviously, when it's risen to the level of compulsion and addiction, that's obviously hurtful. But there's subtle levels. You know, I have friends that I would classify as not alcoholic or drug addicted, but they use a lot of alcohol and a lot of substances, and so that's a distraction in their life. It's not helpful. So again, within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you look at, is this a right action that I'm having a glass of wine right now? It's up for you to decide. You know, again, the Eightfold Path is a middle way. It's not an extreme would be we shouldn't engage in anything. You know, the Buddha lived that life. And then the other extreme would be complete sensory indulgence. I do anything I feel like doing because it makes me feel good. So there's a balance there. What does it do in your life? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a glass of wine. It could be, you know, is your TV on 24 hours a day?
Yeah.
You know, or are you on Facebook constantly?
Yeah.
Those are all acts of compulsive behavior.
Ice cream?
Anything.
Ice cream.
Anything. Yeah, that was it.
Ice cream.
Yeah, that was a big one for me. Ice cream. When I was married, poor Joanne. Every night she would make me, I can't believe I lived past 35. She would make me a grilled cheese and bacon.
Nice.
Fried in butter. And a bowl of ice cream like this.
After dinner?
Oh yeah. This was 9 o'clock at night. We'd had our
wow.
dinner.
God.
And that was, and I did that for years.
Wow.
And our story, oh. And it was me, you know, that was something I had. We talk about creating an identity. We all had this identity. It was a big ritual for her to go in and start doing this. It took me a while to get over that one. But we create craving and clinging identities to anything.
Well, I'm not craving and clinging. It's just that I'm not too terrible. I can't say that I'm too terrible. I have a glass of wine every now and again. Maybe
so... You have a glass of wine once a week. You're certainly not getting intoxicated.
No.
So, the caution or the precept is avoid the use of intoxicants. So, the Buddhism, and that's just the translation too. We don't want to get intoxicated, and we don't want to get.
No.
We can get intoxicated with anything.
With
ice cream, with anything. You know, I see it all the time. We can get compulsive and addicted to just about anything, and people do. You know, all the time. It's just an extreme version of clinging. That's all it is.
And as far as my practice is going, I think I'm, you know, the path. I think I'm kind of on a joke handle somewhere. but I think the teachings are coming together in my mind. I mean, if you teach them, you teach this, and it's really a jigsaw that you need to fit together in your mind, so that the big picture forms in your mind. And I think I've got a reasonable understanding of sort of more or less all that you teach. And now that they're coming together, and the sort of pieces of the jigsaw are blending. As one runs into the other, and I think that's actually what's happening in my mind at the moment, and I'm certainly becoming aware of how much craving and clinging I do, and it's shameful. I mean, really shameful.
Only in your mind.
Well, I don't. I think this is craving. I'll have it this time. and sometimes I have that thought that you know, I know it's craving, but I give into it anyway. You know, I don't. You know, there's always next time. It's like you know, going on a diet or something. You sort of put the craving and clinging off. You can recognize it as your own craving and clinging, but you still do it anyway because that's what you do.
That's
conditioned thinking. I can see the big picture, as far as I understand it right now, anyway. But to actually break those habits and be gentle with yourself, it's quite, you know, it's quite a mental task.
What you're describing is developing right view. You're seeing things differently and more clearly.
Yeah.
We first have to recognize where we're craving and clinging before we can abandon it.
Yeah.
So good for you.
Good question, John. The Buddha, didn't he teach the middle way?
Yes.
Basically, so, you know, just avoid extremes.
Yeah. And when he described that, he said that I teach a middle way between severe asceticism and complete sensory indulgence, meaning we allow ourselves to be human beings during this. We have to be, because that's what we are. The And the Buddha experienced both of those. That's why he taught that. First, he had this luxurious life that he left behind, and then he practiced severe asceticism for many years. Realized that that wasn't it either. He developed this middle way. But so there's forms of asceticism. Denying yourself a glass of wine when that wine doesn't lead to intoxication, to me, would be a form of asceticism.
Yeah.
Now my point, my way of thinking is forced silent retreat for 7 and 10 days, to me, is a form of asceticism. You're cutting off one of your senses. I've never seen the benefit of it, even though I've done it. And it's just such an important question, Mary. We're human beings. You know, the reason why I say we should be gentle with ourselves is allow ourselves to be human beings. We're going to falter along the way. We're going to recognize that we're craving and clinging, and we hope that we're not, but we can't judge ourselves on it. It's just a fact of being a human being. A fully awakened, fully mature human being is still a human being, still living that middle way, but just free of attachment. Again, remember, the Buddha described an awakened human being in completely practical terms. Released or unbound, as a released or unbound from craving and clinging. And he described that quality of mind as calm or equanimity.
I can make the connection of craving and clinging always rooted in your ego.
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
When you really
anatta.
Stop and think.
Yeah.
There's no sidetracking that.
There isn't.
Always your ego.
Yep, and that's why the Buddha taught and used that word anatta, to say not self. So when we're caught up in things, when our ego is clinging and craving and reacting, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. This is anatta, this is not me. If I'm agitated in any way, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And it diminishes, it constantly diminishes the ego personality. Till at one point we're like Kundana. We understand it all. We understand the impermanence of all things. Any other questions? Comments? We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture again. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.